This podcast is sponsored by Talkspace. You know when you're really stressed or not feeling so great about your life or about yourself? Talking to someone who understands can really help. But who is that person? How do you find them? Where do you even start? Talkspace. Talkspace makes it easy to get the support you need. With Talkspace, you can go online, answer a few questions about your preferences, and be matched with a therapist. And because you'll meet your therapist online, you don't have to take time off work or arrange childcare. You'll meet on your schedule, wherever you feel most at ease. If you're depressed, stressed, struggling with a relationship, or if you want some counseling for you and your partner, or just need a little extra one-on-one support, Talkspace is here for you. Plus, Talkspace works with most major insurers, and most insured members have a $0 copay. No insurance? No problem. Now, get $80 off of your first month with promo code SPACE80 when you go to Talkspace.com. Match with a licensed therapist today at Talkspace.com. Save $80 with code SPACE80 at Talkspace.com.
Question for you. Would you rather pay $150 a month or $15 a month to work out with the same high-quality gym equipment? At Planet Fitness, you can get top-tier equipment for $15 a month. Plus, save $28 or more when you join now during our Strong Choice Sale. Our weights weigh the same, you just don't pay the same. Enjoy free fitness training and 24-hour access at most clubs, all in the judgment-free zone. Join Planet Fitness today and save $28 or more when you join for $1 down, $15 a month, cancel anytime. Deal ends October 10th. See club for details.
Earners, what's going on? Listen, EYLU is relaunching, revamping, retooling. That's right, we're creating a new educational experience that's more expansive. Shotty, tell them what we got.
Yes, 2023. We got a lot in store, a lot planned for you guys. So you know that EYLU already includes monthly financial planning calls with me, book club calls with Troy, real estate calls with MG the Mortgage Guy, access to the Home Buying Blueprint, Volume 1 and Volume 2. Part of the revamp will include 27 local chapters from across the United States, live interactive teaching, hands-on, not just pre-recorded videos, plus 15 brand new curriculums.
The biggest just got bigger.
Head over to EYLUniversity.com. That's EYLUniversity.com. See you there.
I've got a really good problem on my hands. How do I solve it? Because I've got more demand than I have seats. We want to make sure we take care of the people that have taken care of us. So all those people that are regulars, that have been regulars, that are great customers, we want to make sure we take care of them. I have 200 seats. The last thing I want to do is just have 200 random people in the restaurant that I don't know. Two Top can come in, order a bottle of sparkling water and split a pasta and leave. That doesn't help me. Or I can know exactly who those two people are that are coming because they're regulars. I know all of their spending habits. I know everything that they like and they don't like. And I can put those two people in there. That totally changes my night. That's how the scarcity model works in my favor, is that I take care of the people that take care of me and take care of the company by making sure they always have access.
Hey guys, welcome back.
Yes, yes.
EYL, we have a very special guest.
This is that has joined us. A New York edition.
For sure, for sure.
Legends of the city.
One of the top entrepreneurs and restaurateurs of our generation.
Definitely.
Mario Carbone. You probably recognize his last name because Drake always raps about his restaurants.
Carbone. Free promotion. Nothing better than free promotion, right?
What do you say? He said, they can't get a reservation at Carbone. They're going to say it's a chill night.
That's one of my favorite bars, for sure.
But
oh, you're getting that late 11 o'clock reservation.
For sure.
That'd be the only one.
For sure. But you built a dynasty in the culinary business, and now you're expanding, you're in fashion, doing a variety of different things. So I know you have a partnership with Amex that we're going to talk about. So this is going to be a great conversation. First and foremost, thank you for joining us. Appreciate
thank
it.
Thank you for having me.
We statistically got a information that it is on record the toughest reservation to get into in the United States of America.
Yeah. I mean, mentioning Amex. So Amex, you know, a few years ago bought Resy. So they have all the statistical information on the reservations there. And we rank, Carbone New York ranks number one by demand.
Yeah.
And Carbone Miami ranks number two by demand.
Okay.
Top two and both.
Have you been to Carbone?
I've been to Carbone Vegas.
Okay. I have not been to Carbone yet.
So no, that's good. We'll see how this thing goes.
Hopefully. We got a feeling I know why I'm here.
This is a New York thing.
All right. So let's just start at the beginning. How do you actually get into the culinary business, and how do you actually start Major Food Group, and what's the first steps to actually building this empire?
I mean, I would take it all the way back to the very, very beginning, which is, you know, me being a child. I think my first influence of the of food was my grandparents, who were born in Italy. They were my babysitter kind of in Queens. They'd watch me, and you know, invariably they'd be in the kitchen doing something, preparing something, working on something. So you know, my early memories and early photos are me in my grandparents' kitchen in Queens. And I think that was an introduction to food, the importance that we put on food as a family. And then I think as I grew up, I never lost that that interest. And I started working in local restaurants when I was about 15, after school and on weekends, just trying to make a little bit of money. And I fell in love with the business of it. And I think that's really important. I think it's important that you, if you're going to choose this profession, that you love them both. It's not enough to just be a really passionate, enthusiastic cook at home, entertainer at home. You think you love this. There's a whole nother side of the business of it that's chaotic. It's intense. It's difficult. It's long hours. It's hard work. You have to love both of those things equally. If you don't, then one of them is probably going to give out over time.
Who mentored you in the business side of it? Because like learning about food costs and employees, like most of the time, if you're just the chef, you're not really. Who did you just do that on your own, or you had like a mentor that actually was showing you the books and showing you how businesses were being?
I think it's a collection of all of my experiences, from the earliest ones, you know, humble local restaurants, into, you know, going to culinary school, leaving there, and then sort of deciding I was going to work for the very best restaurants and chefs all over the world. So I think I took a little bit from all of these places, and I sort of collected business acumen, cooking techniques, you know, thematic ambiances, what was working for different people, what were their styles. And I think eventually that collage becomes your style.
So you blended in from your experiences. But when you get to a culinary school, because I feel like, especially you said you're an 80s baby, I'm an 80s baby, so I'm the same. We don't know too many people that are going to culinary school and what actually happens inside of culinary school. I know there was a great experience for you, but everybody's not the same. So talk about the aspects of actually getting into it, what you're studying, what's practicing, what's happening inside of this place.
I think the biggest thing for me with culinary school was the fact that I wasn't a great high school student. So I never really had the aptitude in high school. I wasn't really that interested. I got whatever grades in high school. And as I was getting towards the end of my time there in senior year, and I realized that my choices after high school were really sort of continuing this mediocrity and lack of interest and aptitude in formal education, or actually try this, what I saw as a vocation, like I'm going to learn this trade.
Mm-hmm.
Because to your point, it still wasn't like a cool thing to do in 1997, right? I wasn't going around telling my boys that I was cooking after school.
Right.
So had I been a better student in high school and had an opportunity to see a path in traditional education, I might have taken it. And that would have taken me somewhere entirely different. So I think in hindsight, it was luck for me that I didn't care at all about school. And I didn't really want to continue it. So I forced myself to do this vocation. And then that triggered, oh, you better make something out of this. Mm-hmm. Like now you made this bed, you know, so now you better make something out of it, because you didn't do it in regular school. Here's culinary school. Don't mess this one up.
Yeah.
And then I started to apply myself.
So, I mean, the first day you get there, you meet somebody that ends up being
changing
somebody
my life. Yeah.
Changed your life forever. So you're talking about luck of even getting there. But the first day you're there, mm-hmm. you meet Jeff.
Yeah. Which I met Rich.
Rich, I'm sorry. Right. You meet Rich, who ends up being your business. How did... Like from day one, did you guys just have a synergy? Were your paths kind of crossing at the same time? Like, yo, we have similar aspirations?
We didn't know that early on. I think it was day one orientation, like you're saying, you know, 1998. And we met, and we both, you know, he was from Westchester, I was from Queens. And it was really that short and that sweet. It was just like, oh, hey, what's up? You know, nice to meet you. You know, we were meeting kids from all over the country, all over the world. And I was like, oh, you're New York. So like, great. Like, nice to meet you. And then later on in our time at school, the girl that he was dating and the girl that I was dating were friends. So we wound up going out to like dinner together and like hanging out a little bit. And I think it was, and we stayed friends through our time there, but I think it was the fact that we both had nearly identical ambition to do the same thing in the same place with virtually the same goals, which was really, I want to go to New York City. I want to graduate. I want to go to New York City. I want to work for the best restaurants, best chefs. I don't care what I have to do. Put my head down, keep my mouth shut, and make myself a great chef. And through those almost identical paths, we wound up staying friends for the next decade. I knew where he was working. He knew where I was working. Sometimes we worked in the same restaurants, which was really cool. We eventually became roommates in the West Village. And then all of that started to really grow like a deep friendship, a brotherhood, to where we trusted each other with our thoughts, with our ideas. You know, we'd stay up late at night talking about our ambition and our ideas and the things we wanted to do. And through that process of becoming so close and divulging in each other, we, when it came time to start a business, we trusted each other very, very much. We knew that that other person had my back and they had the same ambition.
So, okay, you start the business, right? What, you open a restaurant first? That's the first thing you do?
It was probably 10 or 11 years after graduation. So like the first decade is, you know, just keep your mouth shut. Go work everywhere, work for the best, grind it out. It's not glamorous. There's very little money in it, but you're there to just build your experiences and your resume. And then end of 2009, the very beginning of 2010, Rich and I opened our first restaurant. Basically the way that came about was we both had ambition to be entrepreneurs in New York City. And then there was a financial crisis in 2008, which basically meant that any investors for the two of us were dried up. We were unproven, we were young, we had no track record of making anybody any money. So it makes sense that we really had a hard time finding any sort of investment to do this thing. But we were really ready to be our own bosses. So we decided the only way to do it right now would be to do it together. Put aside your personal dreams and my personal dreams. Let's make them collective dreams. And we put the little bit of resources that we had, each had put aside. Each of our families had a little bit of money saved for us and a couple of friends. And we opened a 400 square foot, almost the size of this room, restaurant, if you want to call it that. Six table restaurant.
What was it called?
Teresi Italian Specialties, which still exists now, just a little bit further north on that same block. Six tables, 20 customers at a time. We served, we were basically a deli in the daytime, and we had one menu at night. That was really all we could serve. So sandwiches in the daytime and a menu at night, and that was our very first foray into being businessmen and figuring out all the things that go along with that.
Yeah, but it's the 10 years of experience prior that gets you to this point. So as you're saying it, I'm thinking to myself, what are the things that you're applying from what you've learned when you're grinding? You're not making much money. You're learning about hospitality, I'm sure, food costs, menu options, presentation, all the, what are the things, those key components that you're saying, all right, we need to add this when we start, even in 400 square feet?
We were very confident that we could make the food, we could make something, we could make a product that people wanted. We knew the local press community from being in all these restaurants in New York. We knew who the journalists were. We knew who the critics were. We could get our message out to them, which was important. We were a product of the city, so it felt like they wanted to root for us. We were these young kids from New York doing a very New York thing. Finding our voice was a critical thing early on. Who are we? Mm-hmm. What is this thing we're building? And when we came across the idea that we needed to portray our upbringing in this restaurant. We needed to be Italian American, and what did that mean to us? So when we found that voice, it became easy to speak about it. It became easy to reach out to these journalists. Hey, can you help get our message out there? We're going to open this little thing. And it felt like everybody rallied around us. It was a really beautiful time for us.
Right, so what's the point where you really hit your stride and you start to really take off in this situation?
We got a couple of really incredible critical reviews of that restaurant from New York Magazine, from the New York Times. So that took us from, you need to know about this little place in the neighborhood, to the entire city being made aware of what we're doing in this restaurant. So once those happened, we had pretty quickly outgrown the square footage that we had. We weren't taking reservations at the time, so a line would form early in the afternoon waiting for reservations for that night. Those were those big moments where you're like, oh shit, man, there's a line outside. Like, it wraps around the block, like they're here for reservations. Those were big moments to be recognized by your colleagues like that. At the highest level in New York were big turning points for us.
So you get the write-ups, New York Times, that's huge.
Yeah.
So this is a different time. So like people listening now, like that don't read print.
Yeah.
This is a huge thing. New York Times, like you
pre-social
said.
Pre-social media. I mean,
media.
It existed, well, but.
Yeah, Facebook is
not
the internet.
At all.
Instagram
its
isn't
capacity,
what it is.
Yeah,
right.
Yeah.
You also get Michelin starred.
Yeah.
In 2014.
Yeah.
For the people in the restaurant, this is your stamp. Like at the time when you get Michelin starred, I know things have changed and we'll get into that later, but what does that feel like and what's the process of becoming Michelin starred? And for those who don't know, can you explain what it means to somebody in the restaurant, to your world?
Well, I think the stars that we put the most weight into are and still and will always be the New York Times, I think, for us, because that's the system we grew up reading. That's the paper we'd run to go get to see who was the review that day. So for us, it's always been the New York Times. You know, Michelin wasn't a thing yet in New York when we were coming up. Now Michelin's a big thing and it's a big business. And we could talk for a long time about Michelin. But I'm not exactly sure what the criteria is. Not sure anybody really does. But it's certainly closely watched by a lot of people, and if you are recognized by them, it's a big deal for your business.
So okay, so you get a cult following in New York, then you open up. After that, that's when you open up Carbone.
We wound up taking the space directly next door to Terese, and that became a really casual sort of sandwich shop called Parm. So that was just kind of luck of the draw that the place next to us went out of business. And we wound up having these two stores next to each other. So basically, the deli that was in Terese moved next door, and that just became a restaurant. And we thought that would hold us over for some time, but we kind of quickly outgrew both of those as well. You know, each one really small. I mean, collectively, you're still talking about 1,000 square feet. So it didn't take long before we outgrew both of those little spaces. And the third one was our next big leap, which was taking on a quote-unquote real restaurant, which would be Carbone.
So all right, restaurant industry, I think it's like a 90% failure rate, right? Mm-hmm. Even people that have money, we see a lot of athletes, they're not successful in restaurants. Foot traffic is very random. It's hard to keep people in consistently. What are some mistakes that you see restaurateurs make, and what are the things that you have done differently to break those odds and, you know, be the outlier?
You'd be hard pressed to find an industry with more complexity than a restaurant business, with more moving parts. A business as difficult as it is, that even when you are successful, the percentage of profitability, what is considered successful, is still relatively small for another business, mm-hmm. Which makes the whole thing incredibly difficult. The problem is it's a cool business. So there's an element of vanity involved in these businesses. You want a host, you want your name in lights, whatever it might be. So it looks like a lot of fun. That's where the danger lies. So things that we've done to be successful, I'm not quite sure. I think we tell a very clear story. we have a story and we have a product that I believe people want. Identifying that, knowing that, we try not to build selfish products. We try to remember that there's a customer on the other side of that. Making something that people want, making a great version of something that people want, giving them something that they can't experience on their couch. You know, this day and age, you know, not so much when we started, but this day and age, you know, there's so many delivery services. So like the business has changed a great deal from when we started, from social media to the delivery apps. My business is completely different than when we first started. So we had to adapt as well. So giving them an experience, giving them a night out, making it something that you can't replicate from Uber Eats.
But also the scarcity model, right? Have you manufactured that? Because it's like going to a club, right? If you can see a club that has no line, you're not really interested in going in. But if you see the line is like 3 blocks long, you're at least curious to know why this line is 3 blocks long, right? It, which makes you want to spend more money for bottles. Being that you can't really get into your restaurant, it makes people want to get into your restaurant. Is that done purposely?
I mean, it's not done purposely. You can't fake having a product that's in demand, right? You had to have created the product. Mm-hmm. So it all starts with the product. Like Carbone was a great restaurant. We built a great restaurant. We had no idea the outcome. You know, it was take on a bigger project than we've ever taken on and do your best. Put everything you've got behind it. Make a great product. So it has to start there. And then good problems will come. The good will come out of that. But keep super focused on the product and not the outcome, because there is no outcome without the product. So we built a great restaurant. Thankfully, you know, it's been and continues to be in demand by a really wide demographic of people. You know, for everything from my parents and grandparents to the new athlete that just got drafted, they all love it. And it's rooted in nostalgia, so it touches a lot of people. And then you get into the scarcity model. Then you get into, okay, I've got a really good problem on my hands. How do I solve it? The really good problem is I've got more demand than I have seats. Now we're in a position where we want to make sure we take care of the people that have taken care of us. So all of those people that are regulars, that have been regulars, that are great customers, we want to make sure we take care of them. The last thing you want to do with, I have 200 seats. The last thing I want to do is just have 200 random people in the restaurant that I don't know. They could come in, a two-top can come in, order a bottle of sparkling water and split a pasta and leave. That doesn't help me. Or I can know exactly who those two people are that are coming because they're regulars. I know all of their spending habits. I know everything that they like and they don't like. And I can put those two people in there. That totally changes my night. So that's how the scarcity model works in my favor, is that I take care of the people that take care of me and take care of the company by making sure they always have access to tables.
When you scale, because even when you were talking about the deli and having the restaurant, I'm thinking to myself, most restaurants don't succeed because the hours of functioning, most people are working and they're not there. And if they don't open for lunch, then how do they make revenue? The fact that you have a deli keeps you open throughout the day, and then you can have a restaurant at night, that helps profit margins. When you realize that we need to grow to, like you said, 1,000 square feet now, the process of financing, you went from 2008, where there's a financial crisis, to now it's 2011, 2012, 13. Economy's changing. Is it easier now when you're going to investors to say, hey, I have a proven model, going to banks, hey, we need a loan, here's a proven model, we're in such demand? How was that, going through that at that time?
Incredibly difficult in the beginning, where you're taking, you know, virtually your family's life savings and you're rolling the dice, right? So like, the stakes can't possibly be any higher. You're unknown, you're unproven, except for the people that are closest to you. And then you build something that now has a following. So with the second and the third project, as you're seeking investment, of course, the first people I'm going to go to are the people that I've met, that now I know, that enjoy my product, that are fans of what I do. So now I've got some audience to talk to. To ask for, oh, hey, would you like to be a part of what we're doing next or our future growth? Where I had none of that to begin with. So the snowball starts to happen. You know, it's all positive. It's all the positive snowball that comes from putting out something that people want.
So, and at that point, is that now it's you and Rich? Is Jeff part of this yet?
Jeff's a part of it. He came on really, really early on, pretty much the end of the first year. By the end of our first year in business, Jeff was already part of the company. you know, exactly this point. He was a super enthusiastic early customer of what we were doing at Terezi.
Okay.
Wound up hanging out with us at the end of the night, having drinks. Hey, I love what you do. This is something I want to be a part of. Here's how I think I could help. You know, maybe this dynamic is three instead of two. And over the course of, you know, talking it out with him, I was like, you know, maybe this is the right next person. But without having taken that leap of faith and doing Terezi with, you know, just bootstraps, then I don't really meet Jeff.
No, he never comes in.
So you said something as far as like client retention. That's key for any business, right? It's better to keep clients as opposed to trying to get new clients. Mm-hmm. So, and then you're keeping data and you're tracking how much money they're spending, right? And you know your A clients from your B clients to your C clients. That's true in any business as well. What are you doing to encourage them to come? Your A clients that's spending $5,000 on wine, how are you encouraging them to come back on a regular basis? Are you constantly in staying in touch with them via text messages? Like, what's your communication method?
I think it's, you know, making sure that we have access for them as much as possible, right? In some sort of tiered system. But again, I think all roads always lead to the product, right? We have to stay hot. We have to stay in demand. How do you do that? You got to keep putting out the product. It's always, all roads always lead back to the product. The restaurant to stay hot for a decade means that enough people have come in and had great experiences. And that database grows as a new customer comes in and has a great experience and they want to come back. Great. But if we start to slip and someone new comes in and they're hot, well, then my A customers are going there.
Mm-hmm.
I can't keep them. I can't keep them without the product. All roads lead to it.
So even like in a scenario like that, do you have to, let's say you guys have the ravioli. That's amazing. That's why people are coming. Down the street, somebody's selling the lasagna and you're losing some customers. Are you updating the menu? Are you updating the products to say, all right, well, if that's what the I know you don't like the word competition, we'll say, if that's what the colleagues are doing, mm-hmm. then let's figure out how we add to it to make sure that we can encompass all of them. It's tricky because you don't want to add too many things, right? To make sure that the price points are matching so you can have profit. You don't want to get rid of the old things because you have loyal customers that are coming in for that. How do you balance that?
I'm always working on something. I'm always working on the product. Whether it's something we just opened, something we're about to open, or looking back at something that's existing. I think you look at it, you have to look at it, or you'd like to try to look at it through as many sets of eyes as possible. Be a customer yourself. Be in the kitchen. Talk to the team. Talk to the customers. Read reviews. Collect the data. And that will educate you as to what needs to be done, what shouldn't be done, what should be touched. And then there's just sort of the ambition of it all. Okay, I want this brand to grow with me. You know, I started it in 2013. Let's talk about carbon. I started 2013.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, that's 10, 11 years now. It shouldn't stay stagnant. It should grow while not changing to a point where a person who's never been there before gets a different experience. Finding that balance. And really the only way to do it, it's up to me. The balance is up to me where I want to take it. So it's my personal ambition along with reading the room, collecting the data, finding where I want it to grow. But it's no different than a fashion designer who's in a house that's 10 years old, 20 years old, 30 years old. You have the customers that are loyal followers, and that's great.
When you're with Amex Business Platinum, you have the card that helps you do more of what you love. Like a flexible spending limit that adapts with your business. And with 5x membership rewards points on flights and prepaid hotels booked on AmexTravel.com, going the extra mile for your business is even more rewarding. That's the powerful backing of American Express. Not all purchases will be approved. Terms apply. Learn more at AmericanExpress.com/AmexBusiness.
At Humana, our Medicare Advantage plans give you coverage and care you can count on, along with guided support to help you feel your best. You could have a plan with a $0 premium or an all-in-one plan that may include medical and prescription coverage, as well as routine dental, vision, and hearing. Learn more at GetHumana.com. Humana, a more human way to healthcare. Humana is a Medicare Advantage HMO and PPO organization with a Medicare contract. Enrollment in any Humana plan depends on contract renewal.
Question for you. Would you rather pay $150 a month or $15 a month to work out with the same high-quality gym equipment? At Planet Fitness, you can get top-tier equipment for $15 a month. Plus, save $28 or more when you join now during our Strong Choice Sale. Our weights weigh the same, you just don't pay the same. Enjoy free fitness training and 24-hour access at most clubs, all in the judgment-free zone. Join Planet Fitness today and save $28 or more when you join for $1 down, $15 a month, cancel anytime. Deal ends October 10th. See club for details.
But if you don't continue to gain new followers, it will eventually die. So how do you maintain the integrity of the brand standards that have built this thing while continuing to innovate to gain new customers and finding that balance? That's just growth.
So, okay, multiple streams of income, very important. So you've diversified your portfolio, you have physical products. What's the thought process behind that?
The thought process behind this was we believed that we had built a brand that was nationally known while only having a few hundred seats total, even if you collect all the Carbones in the country. So certainly we can only reach a very, very small demographic of people physically. How do I do something, create something that can reach a much larger percentage of the people that know who we are and would like something based off the product? They'd like a little piece of that restaurant taken home to them. So this was the way that we thought to go about doing that.
Okay. So you want to bottle it. Are you working with somebody? Are you doing this independent? Is it a partnership?
We work with, it starts with us creating this sauce ourselves, like literally Rich and myself creating this sauce on scale.
Okay.
Because, as you get to scales that we're cooking at, the recipes change. So it took us quite some time to get to something that we were really happy with. You're doing it at a bottling plant where sauce is being made on scale. We don't own 100-gallon drums of ovens and kettles. So you do that locally, choosing the tomato, choosing all the ingredients, choosing the cooking process, tweaking the recipes. Every time a new batch is made, they send us a sample so that we can make sure that it's exactly where it's supposed to be. So that's kind of how you go about it. You want to take the same sort of care and thought process with this as you would anything you're making at the restaurants.
Yeah, so multiple streams turns from having the product. I use the product, the tomato basil, like I was telling you. But you have a portfolio of over 40 restaurants.
Yeah, right? Almost 50 now.
Almost 50. All of them, each are kind of unique, right? If you have the Lobster Club, which is different from Carbone, you talked about Parm. What is the process when you're saying, let me look at the landscape, what is it missing, how are you choosing locations, and what to put in each?
I think the process is different. Sometimes it'll come to us, a developer is building something, a hotel or a residential tower, and they say, we have a space available, we'd love to have you part of the project. Sometimes it's us seeking a space because we have, like Teresi, for instance, our original restaurant had outgrown the original space. We need a space. We have to go find one, but we don't want to leave the circumference too far from the original location. So it's often opportunistic how we get a hold of these spaces and then figuring out, okay, working backwards, what does this space want? What does it want to be? Sometimes it's predetermined where a hotel will come to us and say, we're looking to put a Carbone here in this city, and you can either agree or disagree to do the deal. Or it can be abstract. Hey, let me know your thoughts on this project and how you would program it. And then we can go back and sort of take a look back and say, okay, what is that project or that city, that development? What does it want? What does it want to be? What does it want? And work through it. What's the demographic of the city? What do we think the appropriate check average would be? What's the right concept to put there? So each one can be unique of how we get to the answers we get to.
When you look at it, is it ever a situation where there's a real estate component to it where we actually now have ownership or equity inside of these developments? Does that come into play as well for you guys?
Yeah, for sure. You want to, as you get bigger and the brands get bigger, you want to try to leverage them as much as possible. So we're fully aware that food and beverage greatly affects, you know, how you, the customer, feel about that hotel. I stay at that hotel because it's got that great restaurant inside.
This is true.
Or I might buy a condo in that building because it's got a Carbone in it or whatever. Okay, well, if we're affecting it that greatly for the owner of the building or the developer, well, then there should be something in it for us as well. but all, you know, 50 restaurants, we've got 50 different deals. You know, they're all different. They all look a little different. And that's just kind of growth as well, and teaching. You know, no one teaches you this, so you're learning as you go along how to construct these things and how to put them together for the good of the business, the best of the business.
Can you talk about Carbone Beach and the partnership with American Express?
Yeah, absolutely. American Express has been an amazing partner to us for years now, and we've just finished our third year of Carbone Beach. So there's been three. You know, and it's in line with the Formula One race in Miami. So there's been three of those now. And, you know, the first year came about because as this sort of Formula One race in Miami was happening and all the buzz and talk about it coming to Miami, you know, we realized we needed to do something on scale with what was looking like it was going to be the biggest weekend of the year in the city. Like, well, if this is the biggest weekend of the year, we need to go big too. It's not enough to just have the restaurants. So we came up with this idea of this sort of basically old world supper club, very glamorous, you know, weekend of dinners where there'd be a performance, there'd be this over the top meal, all sorts of activations happening around it. But the scale we were talking about was crazy. It was the biggest thing we've ever done, basically building a airplane hangar on the beach of Miami. So we needed help. And Amex has always been, you know, really, really supportive of us, great partners. They were the first people we thought of the call. And Queens guy, Steve Squeri, CEO, shout out to Steve Squeri, the CEO of Amex, McClancy High School. We gave him a call and he was like, absolutely, we would love to partner with you. So that was the beginning of a great relationship and what is basically the Academy Awards for us. I mean, it's the biggest event of the year we put on. It takes virtually the whole year to put it together.
You're talking about high level. I remember last year when I saw Nas on stage and Khaled was just recording and Stout was there, ice sculptures. It was an amazing looking event. I'm sure this year, we missed this year. We were at a dear friend's birthday party out of town, so we missed it. But when I thought about it, and I'm glad you brought up F1, it makes me feel like maybe this is something that could happen at additional F1s. I know you're in Vegas already. And shout out to the Aria because you're in there.
There you go.
One of the reasons we stay. But is there potential to follow events, right? Whether it's the World Cup, which is coming, mm-hmm. It'll be in Miami as well. F1, which travels throughout the world, is that on the vision board as well?
There's definitely demand for it. We've done Carbone Beach in Doha for the Formula One race there. Mm-hmm. We plan to do it again this year there. So some of these bigger events have been reaching out. Based off of the success of the one in Miami, and again, it's for us because it's judging risk reward because it's such a big lift for us. It takes so many team members, so many man hours to put it on to make it great. That, you know, you're always looking at it as you know, what's the risk reward here? What's the level of risk for us to send a whole squad hours and hours away from their home base? I'd say there, to your point, there is definitely growing demand for this Carbone Beach product at big events around the world.
How are you able to manage COVID?
No one was ready for it, right? I mean, there was no sign that this thing was going to happen. So we were just plugging along, New York-based company. We had, I think at the time, maybe almost 3,000 employees. And, you know, we had our plans for the future. We were, you know, I remember exactly where we were the last night we were in business before that happened. And this thing comes out of nowhere and decimates the business landscape. So then we turn around and a week or so later, we have 20 employees on the payroll and one functioning restaurant, which was Carbone on Thompson Street.
3,000 to 20.
Yeah. and one functioning restaurant, which was Carbone, and Carbone was putting rigatoni in to-go boxes. We didn't, like everybody else, didn't really know what hit us. But I think that what we did really well in that moment was pivot hard, fast. And we came together, we talked, and we said, we're not going to accept not being able to do business. So where can we go do business? And virtually the only city in the world that was up and running and conducting business and conducting life as was nothing was happening was Miami, Florida.
And Atlanta.
Atlanta.
And, maybe Atlanta.
Atlanta didn't have a
like,
beach.
COVID didn't come here.
Never existed. For 2 weeks. 2 weeks it existed.
For sure.
Yeah. We're like, okay, yeah. Miami. We know people in Miami. We wanted to go to Miami. Miami was on the board. Let's make some calls. Let's go there quick. And we grabbed the space, a AAA space, because like everybody else, restaurants were closing all over the place. So we were like, well, wait a minute. These restaurants are closing. We don't know how long COVID's going to last, but it's not going to last forever. So if we see a AAA space, grab it. We'll figure it out later. So a AAA space in South Beach came available. We grabbed it.
AAA means what?
AAA, like this is as good as it gets, a piece of real estate.
This is prime.
Prime piece of real estate. Literally next to Prime in Miami. And like right behind Joe's, like, this space is crazy.
Yeah, Nikki Beach.
We have to take this space. Yeah. So we took it, and we set up a company-wide Zoom call. Anyone in the company that had previously been with us could join. And we're like, we as a company are making a move to Miami, Florida, and we're doing it right now. We don't know how long New York's going to be closed, but we know the city is open. So anyone who has had a job with us, anyone who's just been furloughed, there's work for you in Miami. Come down. So we had enough people come down. So now we have, not only do we have an amazing space, but we have our team. Mm. They're now making money again. They're getting checks.
From New York.
From New York. That came down, and we opened Carbone 10 weeks later. We had the restaurant up and running. And it crushed, because it was one of the only restaurants functioning in one of the only cities functioning. And that was the beginning of Miami becoming another tent pole for the company that we had never expected. And one became 13 restaurants in Miami really fast, mm-hmm. because we were there. Mm-hmm. Our team was there. And then once New York came back around, and now it's flourishing again, the company's twice the size it was. And COVID, you know, one of the great Warren Buffett quotes is, be fearful when people are aggressive, be aggressive when people are fearful. And we were incredibly aggressive in a very fearful moment, and we just started scooping up spaces because this is gonna end eventually.
Mm. Man, that's crazy. So another prestigious club that you have that is almost as difficult to get into, the ZZ Club. Can you talk to us about that? I know people might have heard it mentioned in songs, and the breakdown of it, because again, you've had a base for almost 10 years. And so how do you keep them coming back? How do you make something new? I feel like ZZ Club becomes that. We'll talk about the price points and the applications and all that. But when you're coming up with this, what's the thought process?
So the first ZZ's Members Club, which is our members club, was built in Miami as part of the big COVID boom for us. Again, another incredible space that came available. And we had predicted and saw the beginnings of members clubs finally becoming popularized here in the States. So we wanted to get ahead of that a little bit. And we thought that our fan base, our customer base, would accept and really enjoy having this sort of enclosed network. So we found a space that was really conducive to it, which was a two-floor space kind of tucked into the design district of Miami. We thought it was a great location. And we used the second floor basically like an amenity space, where there's a cigar terrace, there's a cocktail bar, there's a lounge that kind of turns up late at night. Downstairs you have a restaurant, sports bar. You know, it's the idea is one-stop shop. You're going to walk in, we're going to take care of you for the night. And what I like about members clubs is that it affords us the opportunity to create more than just what the walls of a traditional restaurant are. I can take care of you more than that. I can take care of you in different ways. It's hospitality seen through a new lens. There's a movie night, there's a NBA finals, we're gonna do cocktails and snacks based off that. We're doing a cigar dinner tonight hosted by Cohiba, whatever it is, we're doing a wine dinner. So it's greater than just the traditional walls, which was a challenge that I really liked. And I thought an ecosystem that my fan base, my customer base would enjoy. So we took our first crack at it in Miami. It went really well. And then we opened one here in New York.
Now, the fee that comes with the application, right? Because it's a pretty high fee. Is there a guarantee that you're in? Or what's the selection process like for it?
So there's an application process.
Yeah.
And basically, you know, you want to be recommended by an existing member so that we keep the group of people really friendly. We mm-hmm. want, you know, people getting up from tables and going to visit other tables, and everyone knows each other. Like-minded individuals is what most clubs are looking for. So our application process is really no different than any other. There's usually a board that will go through them once a month or so mm-hmm. and figure out who are the right fits here in the club. How many more people are we looking to add to it? You want to be cognizant not to add too many members, because the point of this is access. So you don't want them hearing no too frequently. I can't get you in. I can't have you. There's no seat for you in the sports bar or whatever. So finding the balance of it's buzzing in here. It feels like the energy is really good mm-hmm. and I can always kind of get in is a threading of a needle there that we need to be conscious of at all times.
So Our Lady of Rocco clothing, how do you transition from culinary to clothes?
Our Lady of Rocco is really, well, I've been able to be part of the design process for the uniforms of the companies pretty much since the beginning. Working with some amazing designers like Tom Ford when he built the uniform process at the Grill, Zach Posen, who made the very first uniform for us at Carbone. So being a part of the process with some amazing designers and then doing it a little bit for myself for the company. I say about Rocco that at this point, it's really an elaborate hobby for me. It's like the equivalent of me painting in my free time. It just keeps my mind lubricated. You know, maybe at some point it'll grow beyond a hobby, but I think right now it's that. It's a way for me to have an outlet that's a little off center from what I traditionally do. I think it helps me in my day job, quote unquote. And it's always cool when I see somebody in the dining room wearing something that we made.
Obviously, there's a sense of fashion that you have and a respect for it. Talk about, because it reminds me of a time, and we're all from the same era, where when you went out, you had to present yourself a certain way. Dress codes meant a thing. These things don't mean as much as they used to, but I feel like when you have a private club, when you have a specific theme that you're trying to set inside of restaurants, you can dictate that, right? So talk about the importance of presentation and dress code, I guess, for your establishments.
So we don't have a dress code anywhere, really, aside from, like, you know, no shorts, no sandals in Miami, things like that. But we're not, you know, by no means jacket required or anything like that. I don't want to create too many restraints for the customers. But certainly as an old soul, it makes me smile when I see somebody wearing a blazer or a suit in the restaurant. I like that. But I get it. It's not for everybody. Certainly as my demographic sometimes skews, you know, a little younger, like in this day and age of the $1,000 hoodie, like that's what fancy is. That's what going out is. What I say is try to meet the amount of time your girl put in to getting dressed tonight or get close. Like you can't just throw on a hoodie. Like it took her an hour and a half to get ready. Like that's what you're putting on tonight? Like you guys are both going out, right?
So same place.
You go to it's a nice restaurant. Yeah. So I kind of always have my dad's voice in my head when I'm leaving the house. It's like, you gonna leave the house looking like that? Where are you going? A nice restaurant. Like,
yeah.
You have a sweatshirt on. Yeah.
So we've seen a lot of restaurants turn to like slash clubs, like Tao,
mm-hmm.
and then we've seen other restaurants like Noble. They have a hotel. This something that you kind of envision, like a Carbone full-fledged nightclub or even a Carbone resort, Carbone hotel, like, you know, in the next stage of the hospitality?
I think for sure stretching out what hospitality means to us is something that we are actively working on, you know, and I think it's the one, it's in areas where we're passionate and where we think it makes sense. So like nightclub won't make sense for us because it's just not us. It's not our vibe. I have no interest in being like a nightclub guy, but Carbone Hotel, I'd love to open, you know? I don't know the opportunities that'll come next, but certainly growing in the space of hospitality is something that we're working on. Hotels, branded residences, consumer packaged goods, private clubs, all of those areas we're actively working on or already in, for sure.
In a day and age now, I wonder what marketing looks like for you guys, because I feel like we hear a bunch of artists say your name. I feel like Nori is has a residency.
Shout out, Nori.
I mean, Nori's ridiculous. I mean, every week he's there, so it feels like you're getting promotion every day on social media. How much does marketing come into the bottom, the baseline of what you guys have to spend? Because I feel like people just promote it in social media every day.
Yeah, I mean, we're very lucky to have a diehard group of fans that you know, talk about it, come in, you know, they're really well known. And in this day of social media, like, everyone's got a following, right? So that's changed dramatically of how you market your business, all businesses, because everybody is a marketer now, for good, you know, good or bad, if they liked it or they didn't like the experience, depending on the size of their following, that's a big needle mover. So we're very lucky to have a diehard fan base there. And then for us, yeah, I mean, marketing has never really been a huge category for us. I think that it's something I have ambition in putting more effort and more dollars spent into in the coming years. I think we're actually deficient in marketing right now as a company. I think we need to grow that category. I think the marketing that's opportunistic, somebody comes in and they post about it, is great, but continuing to make sure that people know we are this family of products. Oh, I didn't know you own that restaurant is a knock on our marketing, right? We need to be better about that, about putting the family of goods together, so that you know who we are. You know, we have, you know, we're all of these different brands, and I want to make sure that Major Food Group, the mother company, is known as an entity of in the luxury hospitality space.
Yeah, like a Darden Group.
Yeah.
Do you have any aspirations of becoming like a celeb, like, so Gordon Ramsay, there's a lot of celebrity chefs, right? Do you have, people know your last name, but do you have aspirations of like becoming more in the forefront as a personality?
No, I don't think I do. I mean, I've had chances to sort of go down that road before. I've never really wanted to be the face of the restaurant. I like Carbone standing for something, but not necessarily for me. Certainly with each passing year, I find myself more and more being a promoter of the brands. And I think that I enjoy speaking on behalf of the company, but I don't want to take on anything that's going to take too much of my time away from what I do day to day for the business. And those jobs, being those, you know, commercial forward guys and girls, like, that takes a huge amount of time. They're really good at it. It takes a lot of work. And I'm always fearful that it's going to take too much of my time away from what I do.
And you said you have to love the food and you have to love the business. And it sounds like, I mean, it's evident when you talk. Are there parts of it when you look at it, like, you know what, I really don't like that part of this, the business. Like, if we could tweak that, this thing could be really, really, really amazing. What part of the business do you wake up and say, we're just not getting this right? Or as an industry, I wish we did better.
Yeah, I think it's our job to focus. It's our job as ownership to focus on the things that aren't going exactly the way you want to. And we need to have those conversations almost daily. And sometimes the answer is I'm just not that good at that. I need to go seek out who the best and the brightest is at that thing for us. So it's identifying that at all times, not getting too caught up in you know, hearing about how great it is or how popular it is, or, you know, it's really spending the time to focus on the areas that we can get better at. And, you know, often the answer is talent. You know, constantly looking for, you know, the next great person to add to the company, or, you know, great company that we can collaborate with that is experts in their field, you know, because we're always testing the waters of new. So if you're testing the waters of new, then you're on shaky ground of something you haven't been down the road of yet. So, you know, at times you can get beat up with all the things that aren't going well or maybe not going right. But that's, you know, that's the double-edged sword of testing the boundaries, I think.
Yeah. Do you've acquired some of the colleagues, right? How is that, right? When you did it to somebody who used to have an establishment, you saw greatness in it, you saw some things that they can improve on, but knowing the owner and maybe knowing the chef, maybe, you know, you have gone to school with them. What are those conversations like when you're looking to acquire a potential colleague?
That's a new arm for us and something I think we're going to be more active in that space in years to come, which is sort of, you know, mergers and acquisitions. That's a great way to bring talent into the company by identifying brands and people behind those brands that we think operate at excellence. And it needs to be mutually beneficial. You know, that company or that owner, that chef wants to be part of this company because collectively we can grow that brand greater than potentially they can on their own. And for me, I can bring in this talent, the talent behind what I believe is a great brand, because I think it fits really nicely somewhere in the portfolio. And as the company as a whole, now that we are the size that we are, we have the infrastructure that we have, I can lend something to them. So it always needs to be mutually beneficial. But it's an exciting thing that we're thankfully in a position we're able to do.
Well, I want to thank you for your time. And any last words to aspiring restaurateurs or business moguls in the making that, you know, you can give them some advice on?
Focus on the product. Don't focus on the outcome. Whatever you're doing, make it great, and the good things will come from it.
There you have it. Ladies and gentlemen, thank you guys for rocking us. See you next week. Peace.
Peace.
This October, Tanger invites you to shop pink and save lives. Your donation of $10 or more to the Breast Cancer Research Foundation helps fuel innovative research that brings us closer to a cure. It also unlocks exclusive savings from brands like Coach, Crocs, Columbia Factory Store, and more to shop all month long. Join us as we mark 30 years of advancing research and empowering hope. Donate and access your exclusive savings today at Tanger.com.
Question for you. Would you rather pay $150 a month or $15 a month to work out with the same high-quality gym equipment? At Planet Fitness, you can get top-tier equipment for $15 a month. Plus, save $28 or more when you join now during our Strong Choice Sale. Our weights weigh the same, you just don't pay the same. Enjoy free fitness training and 24-hour access at most clubs, all in the judgment-free zone. Join Planet Fitness today and save $28 or more when you join for $1 down, $15 a month, cancel anytime. Deal ends October 10th. See club for details.